Hello and once again welcome back to the official Scottish Rugby Podcast. On the show this week we are joined by National Clinical Director for Scotland, Professor Jason Leach, and our very own Chief Operating Officer, Dominic Mackay. Jason, first of all, I'll come to you. Welcome back to the podcast. It's been a couple of months since we had you on. If you just kick us off, and I think it'd be quite good for everyone, a general update on the current situation of COVID-19 in Scotland, please.
Oh, thanks for having me again. And I noticed we've been joined by an actual proper rugby player on this occasion. So Alec Ellock's been here all these months, but now I realise an athlete has joined the crowd. on this occasion. I'm delighted to be back.
Yeah, as Jamie says, great to have you back, Jason. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
I think he's on about Dominic, Al.
I hope he was.
It may well be.
So, Jamie, sorry, it's a good question. The fundamental news is good, but there are some tricky signs. So let's do the good news first, quickly. So Scotland still remains in control of the virus. The numbers on a daily basis remain low. There are very few people sick in hospital or intensive care. Let's not forget that over 4,000 people have died and lost loved ones in this disease. This is not to be trifled with. We should take it very seriously. There are two things that worry us, though. One is the outbreaks. So you've seen a Dumfries and Galloway, a Lanarkshire call centre, and now probably the most significant outbreak we've had in Aberdeen related to, let's call it, the nighttime economy, a set of pubs and hospitality where it began. And now up to over 150 positives, 850 contacts, all self-isolating. So that is being controlled, but I couldn't yet tell you today it is in control. So we have to be very careful. And that's why we've put in a little mini lockdown in Aberdeen. The other thing that worries us all is the global position. Now, that feels a bit abstract to people, probably, particularly folk listening to this in Scotland or talking about their own sport. But today, the world reaches 20 million infections. That nobody's ever lived through anything like this. Mm. It's completely unprecedented. 750,000 people have died of this disease. So I love talking about sport, and let's do that in the next few minutes. But as we do that, let's keep in perspective what this disease has done to this country and to the world. And if we keep that in the right perspective, then we can come out of it safely, and rugby can get back, and other sports can get back, and little shops and restaurants and everything else can get back. But that's the bits that worry us, Jamie. But the Scottish numbers, to go back to the good news, the Scottish numbers remain good.
Yeah, I think we'll echo that, absolutely. It's so important, such a difficult period for everyone. But as I say, we are moving forward, and there's a date in the Scottish Government diary for the 24th of August when adult community sport can hopefully resume. That's just so important, not just rugby, but all sports, and just getting the community back active, fit, healthy, and enjoying their sport again.
So, Chris, it's a great point. We've tried really hard to and it's not always obvious. People criticise you've opened this sector. Why have you done bingo halls before this? So whoever, I upset everybody all the time. Every piece of the route map you open, you get an inbox full of people that you didn't open. But you're trying to balance a whole load of things. You're trying to balance harm from the virus, of course, but you're also trying to balance economy and business, because people. Employment is a public health intervention. People get mentally ill when they lose their jobs, mm-hmm. or they lose their businesses. And that's true of employees in rugby clubs, employees in small retail. And then we're also trying to balance the harm that sport gives to the population. So we brought kids' sport back before most other countries, not even contact sport for kids, because it's so, so important that the kids are physically active. They learn about teamwork. They learn about confrontation. They learn how to play as a group. Boys and girls can start to learn some of those life skills that rugby, football, golf can give them. We think it's really important.
Dominic, from a Scottish rugby point of view, Shiel Begbie and the rugby development team have been doing a huge amount of work on that roadmap, working with the Scottish Government to get as many kids and adults back playing at the right time, at the safest time. How pleased are you with the progress that's been made in recent weeks?
Well, it's been great to work so closely with the government, been great to work with Jason and his colleagues, because we as a governing body see the importance of getting as many young people back out playing sport in whatever way is appropriate. And I think we're sort of lucky in some respects that rugby has got a flexibility that you can play touch rugby, you can play tag rugby, you can train with your mates in a way that keeps you distant and respects the challenge that we're all sort of facing with COVID. So it was great to make some progress in the last sort of few months to get young people back out playing in the sport that they love, even in a touch sense. And then we're going to graduate that following the government's roadmap to get adult rugby back to playing later this month. But what we're seeing from a rugby perspective, from a governing body point of view, is that we'd like to take our time getting contact rugby resuming. And again, we've got that flexibility in the sport that you can play touch rugby and allow yourself to get fit through that before you have to start thinking about full contact rugby. And I think the rugby community across Scotland, we've got 235 clubs from Shetland in the north down to all our clubs in the Borders and Dumfries, and they've been magnificent to date grappling with the challenge. They've been great in the local communities in terms of supporting the local communities over the last number of months, and they'll continue to do that. And they want to play their part. Rugby clubs want to play their part in restarting important aspects of health and sport in their areas, but only when it's right and proper. So our colleagues in rugby development are working really hard to try and find the right way to get rugby restarted at the adult level, and recognising that we've got to be mindful that it's, you know, we can't be complacent. We must make sure that we do everything that's appropriate to protect the country, because it's a fragile environment at the moment, as you just heard from Jason.
And one of those kind of initiatives is COVID-19 officers at each of the clubs that have to sign up. And even this week, there's extra kind of Zoom calls and meetings just to finalise all this. So it really is a buy-in from the community, every club, the nation over, really.
Yeah, the clubs have been incredible. So we've got, I think, over 150 COVID officers aligned to rugby clubs across Scotland. So they're the point of contact for that club with the governing body, and to be disseminating information, making sure that the clubs, many of which are managed and supported by volunteers, have got the right information. They make the right decisions about restarting their clubhouses and rugby and training and activity. And it's all done through the prism of knowledge. We've had about 5,000 people sign up for our COVID online e-learning. So that's impressive. So the rugby community is stepping up, taking its responsibilities in the communities that it operates really seriously. And I'm really proud that as a governing body, we've been able to share as much information and cascade that from the government as early as we possibly can. And we'll keep doing that because, you know, it's fragile, as we talk about, but it's so vital to get rugby started for mental health and for physical health. And people, I think, just want to get an opportunity to be back seeing their pals. And if they can do that through sport, whether it's football or rugby or golf, whatever it might be, it's going to have a really positive effect on the nation beginning to restart in that graduated way that we always talk about.
Jason, how important is that from your point of view? That we're all moving into a new set of circumstances as far as return of not just rugby, but all sports. There's a huge amount of learning that needs to be done to learn how to do it in a safe way. Coupled with the point that Dominic makes about the fact that there's innovation in all sports and there's the ability to make the sports safer by taking certain elements out. You're speaking to governing bodies all the time. What's the appetite like to see those innovations and to get back as safely as possible?
It's really strong, but the government, it's really refreshing to hear Dom say it's been good to work with the government. That's not a sentence you hear every day. But the government has a different job to the rugby authorities, and rightly so. So we can set the kind of high level guidance that said have a COVID officer, make sure you've got hand sanitizer, have one way systems, have a distancing for players who aren't on the pitch. But Murrayfield looks very different from the football stadium in St Johnstone. So you need local guys and girls to make those decisions locally, and that might be a national decision about rucking or mauling or how we're going to do training, or it might be a very, very local decision that says, well, the rugby club in Elgin is going to do this way. We're going to bring our 14-year-olds back first because that's our small boys team or whatever. And so you got to allow that to push downwards. And as I see sports begin to do that, the sports who are doing it well are doing that kind of graded from the top to the bottom work. You cannot just send everybody a laminated sheet mm-hmm. with my face on it, with the facts down the right-hand side, and expect COVID to go away. Mm-hmm. You've got to do that top-level guidance, but then you've got to allow, as Dom says, the volunteers in particular, and those who know the club, know the people, know how the one-way system to the bathroom works. We can't manage that. They've got to manage that. And I think rugby has proved itself to be very community-built, community-focused, even in the extra things they've done during lockdown with food deliveries or checking in on the elderly or retired players coming back to help, or whatever it might be. And that local is so important. And then you get to how you're going to bring back the national game and what you're going to do at Murrayfield. But these are different things.
Just on the point about local, it's a really good point, because what we've tried to say is there won't be one solution for rugby that fits every part of the country. So one of the things we're doing just now is consulting and speaking to all of our clubs, our domestic amateur clubs, to see what does a season look like going forward? How do we structure it to protect ourselves against the virus? How do we innovate in clubhouses? How do we make sure the leagues and the way that we play our leagues are appropriate for this strange environment? So I guess we've tried to use a backdrop of COVID to have those challenging conversations about structuring the competition in the most appropriate way. So maybe it's not appropriate to have national competitions where people might be traveling the length and breadth of the country. Maybe it's more appropriate to have regional rugby for this one season, if this is how long it takes. We need to make a change to our structure that's appropriate for the current environment. And the buy-in that we've had from our clubs has been great. They want to engage in that conversation because they recognise that they've all got an important role to play in their communities. And the same way that high-profile players have a role model responsibility to the nation, rugby clubs are rightly going to be beacons in their local communities. And if they can come up with new smart ideas, it will reflect very positively on them as a club and ultimately as a sport.
Looking, Dominic, to the return, not just of domestic rugby, but of professional rugby. There's two dates now in, and everybody very much looking forward to them from a Glasgow Edinburgh Derby point of view, the 22nd and the 28th of August. There's also an appetite, let's call it at the moment, to run a pilot event on the 28th, where there might be the opportunity to put a small crowd in to watch that game. Can you just give us a bit of an update on where we are with that?
Yeah, so we've got to try and resume, if we can, the Guinness Pro 14, which is the professional competition that Glasgow Warriors and Edinburgh Rugby play in. For my sins at the moment, I happen to be chairman of this cross-border competition. And of all the times, to be the chairman of a league that plays in different parts of Europe and indeed the world with South African teams is a bit of a challenge. But again, innovation, the league's coming up with new ideas. So to try and conclude the season, the way that the league are looking at finalising that is to have derby games in each of the territories. So that would mean that the derby games in Scotland between Glasgow and Edinburgh are on the 22nd of August and the 28th of August, both at BT Murrayfield, because that's a bubble that we've created with the government support and guidance. So we're really looking forward to that. I happened to be in Scotland last week watching a little bit of training, and it was lovely to see the players reacting to be back out playing with their mates, playing a bit of rugby, getting back into the swing of things at Scotland. I've been at Murrayfield the week before to see Edinburgh. So the players are really looking forward to playing those games. We want to make sure that we get the first game, which is behind closed doors on the 22nd, away, and we make sure all the learnings that we have around that game that we improve on. And we're constantly looking at different sports around the world, actually, to improve and make sure we've got the best practice. And then we're hoping and work with the government to see if is it possible to have a small-scale pilot event on the 28th. And the reason why we think it's helpful to offer the suggestion of a pilot event to the government is to make sure that we have some learnings. We've got some clear interventions about how we want to structure and change the nature of a small crowd coming into to BT Murrayfield. And then make sure that we've got those learnings ready to be improved upon before any further resumption of potentially smaller crowds can be brought back into stadiums. But we've tried to be solution-minded, because we recognise that, you know, Jason and his colleagues in the government are trying to grapple with an enormous public health crisis. They can't be into every part of every sector's nuance. So we've tried to say, how do we provide solutions ideas, thoughts to the government. Some of them are going to work, some of them are not going to work, but we want to try and be positive and try to assist the government. And one of those things is around pilot events. And if that proves helpful to government and it proves helpful for the broader events industry to begin to restart in a graduated way in the coming months, then we've at least started from a very solid base. We're fortunate that Murrayfield is large, it's open air, so you can walk from the tram stop or from your car all the way to your seat without having to go inside. And that's something that we think is quite helpful in addition to all the interventions that we'll put in place. So we're discussing those, we're still sort of chatting that through with various people in government, but what we want to be is solution-minded to try and offer the government the opportunity to begin to restart high-performance sport with crowds for all sorts of obvious reasons, but do that in the most respectful way that's possible to get it gradually returning to normal.
And Jason, how beneficial for you guys would that be at an actual practical event where you can get, you know, understanding of what goes right, what potentially may go wrong as well? You can learn a lot from what can be improved, but an actual physical event, how important would that be for you guys in terms of getting supporters back in stadium?
Chris, in principle, we are supportive, and Dom's absolutely correct that that's being developed in partnership with a number of different pieces of the government, including health, but also the events people in government who do major events. I'm not trying to dampen expectations, but remember, we've had to learn a new word in COVID, a number of new words. One of them is indicative. Mm-hmm. So we have given indicative dates for mm-hmm. stuff to yeah. happen, whether it's a bingo hall opening or live events. So I can't come on today
yeah.
and say these dates are when these things are going to happen, but you can see a sequence, quite a sensible sequence, which Dom has outlined there. So when we started sport, there was an interesting call. I think I've maybe described it to you guys before, that we had with horse racing, football and rugby. And rugby said, it's going to take us 10 weeks to get the players ready because mm-hmm. they're high performing athletes. And football said, nah, we can get them ready in 6. Our guys can be ready much quicker because they're not all sitting on the sofa. And the horse racing guys said, well, our athletes are ready tomorrow. So they've been exercising the whole time. So horse racing came back first. Football mm-hmm. is back. We can discuss some of that, maybe just as a little bit of a warning to mm-hmm. some of the rugby players. And then rugby will be next. We're also starting elite golf this week. So there's a big LPGA event happening in Scotland in a bubble with testing, with nobody going to Tesco, everybody going from airport to hotel to match. And you can see in that sequence, a test event with spectators makes perfect sense, particularly in an environment like Murrayfield. Because remember, the test event is not just about the crowd at the pitch. Mm-hmm. It's about getting the crowd there. It's about security and police. It's about transportation. It's about TV. It's about everything else that you have to do around a major event, not just getting 30 yep. elite sports people to play on a piece of grass. It's about everything else that goes around that. And that's why I've been supportive of mm-hmm. Dom going through this process. My only reserve is we are hopeful of those dates. But if, for example, 2 weeks ago, Grampian went out of control yeah. and we lost control of Grampian, I can't guarantee anything.
It's ever changing, isn't it?
Yeah. So far, though, the route map is following what we suggested the route map would do, with some blips along the way. Mm-hmm. But if people follow the guidance, we appear to be keeping the curve down.
So it's a brilliant point that Jason makes there, which is sometimes we often think about the event as just taking place at the stadium. So a lot of the reflections that we're now having to do, and we're linking in with our colleagues in police, our colleagues in transport, our colleagues around retailers, how do we make sure that any supporter that's coming to BT Murrayfield, for example, for the pilot event, from when they leave home to when they get to the stadium and back again, that whole route is thought through, is planned and is discussed. And some of the discussions that we've had with the transport providers in the last few weeks have been fantastic. So they're up for the challenge. So whilst we're saying that we're up for innovation, I think a lot of the sectors that we're working with recognise that for themselves to get restarted, they need to innovate, and perhaps pilot events can be assistance around that. But it's a big thing. Just don't just see it as the event itself. It's that sort of home to home.
I agree.
So Dom, part of that roadmap from a Scottish rugby point of view will be a lead-in towards the end of October, where the beginning of an autumn series and actually the conclusion of the Guinness Six Nations from last year is due to take place. Can you give us a bit of detail as to what that series will look like at the moment, as well as concluding that final game against Wales?
Yeah, so a couple of weeks ago, we managed to get World Rugby to agree to extend the international window so that we could try and get the Six Nations concluded from 2020 and put together some sort of autumn schedule, recognising that there are a bunch of nations who are going to be unable to play that. So, for example, we were due to play Japan, Argentina, New Zealand, and it's unlikely that all of those teams will be able to travel. Perhaps one of them will be able to travel, but certainly all three of them wouldn't be able to travel. So we're looking to do a bit of a blend between the home unions and some guest teams. So probably like an eight nations type tournament during the course of October, end of October, November, beginning of December, and also conclude that Guinness Six Nations. So it's possible that we might have three games at BT Murrayfield during that window, and a couple of games away, one of which, of course, will be that Wales game. That's all virus-dependent. It's all dependent on, the plans that we have in place to put that together. But we're, as a sport, internationally minded, so we're always looking at what's happening in different parts of the world just by the dint of our professional competition or our international competitions. And that probably assists us to be a little bit more focused and making sure we remind all of our players, all of our officials, all of our staff about not being complacent at any moment, because it's vital for us to keep doing what we can to get the sport restarted. But when we get to November, hopefully we've got a window to play some games. And if we can play those games with small crowds or graduated crowds to help the economy restart, that's something we'll be keen to try and support the government on.
And Jason, you mentioned, you know, blips, bumps in the roads, and you alluded to it there as well, or around other things that have come out this week, perhaps in the sporting world. Just talk us through, I guess, this is still on a knife edge, this whole situation. We are still in a precarious situation, and these two incidents surely highlight that, don't they?
Yeah, we are, Jamie. There's two elements of this story, and let's not do the whole backstory. People will have read the back pages and seen my and the First Minister's disappointment over the last couple of days around footballers, actually not the regulatory bodies or the clubs. This has been individual decisions, as far as we know so far, by individual people. Now, that applies whether you're an elite sports person or you work in a factory or a warehouse or you're a school teacher. So it goes back to what I've said to you guys many times, that the difference in a pandemic is your individual behaviour affects the population. Mm-hmm. So the first thing these guys did was put themselves and their families at risk. Then they put the population at risk. And the added layer these guys have is they put elite sport at risk. So we have persuaded the cabinet of the country that sport bubbles work, that sport bubbles are the way to get back elite sport. You are not, forgive me, you are not an essential industry. You don't need rugby to run a country. Mm-hmm. However, we have given special privileges to football, rugby, to sport, to allow them to go back to work inside these bubbles. And in the main, the sports have done a fantastic job of the guidance, of talking to their players, their coaches, their officials, all of that. And these incidents put that at risk. And you can see why, because if I go into the room with the First Minister and she says to me, are the sports bubbles working? That's a harder question to answer today than it was a week ago, if I'm honest. So hopefully these two in particular, there's a couple of other peripheral ones, these two in particular are a bit of a wake-up call, not just to football. Football happens to be on the back pages just now, but also to all other elite sports people and other people in the public eye, in fact, that just as the First Minister said at one of the briefings, keep the heat. you've got special responsibility. People look up to you. You will be photographed on Instagram. You can be under no doubt that people will look out for you. So therefore, keep yourself safe first, your family safe, but also take a responsibility for the sport.
Dominic, on that, I assume that the messages to our players have been fairly robust in their as an understanding. You can never say never, but they understand the importance as to everything that Jason's saying now.
Yeah, massively so. And we recognise as a sport that we are in a privileged position. We've been given a dispensation by the government to allow our elite athletes to perform their job, to allow the elite athletes to operate in a bubble, to train, to be fit, to be active, to be healthy, and to get back out and play sport. So we need to take that responsibility very, very seriously. So our players to date have been magnificent. You know, we've got players at Glasgow, players at Edinburgh, all the coaching staff now back, active, working both at Scotland and at BT Murrayfield, and they've been fantastic. But we cannot be complacent. We talk about complacency being the enemy of success. So we must make sure that every single opportunity our players recognise the importance of a small sacrifice that they have to make to enable them to continue to operate in that bubble. I happened to speak to both head coaches of Glasgow and Edinburgh today to thank them for the constant messaging that they're giving to the players and to pass on our thanks to the players. But just to make the point, as we've done consistently over the last number of weeks, that we just cannot be complacent and that our players are role models, as Jason mentioned there. You know, they will be seen, they will be noticed. And rugby players, as you guys are examples of, are not easy to hide in a busy environment. So you'll stand out. But more importantly, it's a small sacrifice for them to make just to protect themselves, their families, their friends, and the sport. Because if we can't get rugby restarted, it has a significant impact on the sport, both financially but also reputationally. And we don't want to overplay that, but it's an enormous challenge to us. We've got to work really hard to keep ourselves as protected as we possibly can over the next number of weeks and months.
Well, looking at those number of weeks and months and what the future holds, another group of players that have come back or are coming back this week are women's players. They have an enormous 6 months, 8 months ahead of them with the game's been finished from last year's Six Nations, as well as a World Cup qualifying tournament. And then just at the turn of the year on our Six Nations. So it must be great to see the women's players coming back into training.
Well, I couldn't be more delighted to get the women's team back into training. They'll be back in tomorrow into Orium, the National Performance Centre. And then we'll have sites in Glasgow. And in due course, all being well in Aberdeen, we'll have Aberdeen Sports Fillies to host some of the women up there in due course. It's a huge year for women's rugby as you look to qualify for the World Cup and to finish off the Six Nations. So it's right for them to get together. It's a big year for that whole sport because it's such an important part of our sport. It's the fastest growing part of rugby, is women's rugby, and we've been really proud of the growth. But in this COVID fragile environment, we never want anyone to be forgotten about or left behind. And whilst the international men's team or the professional rugby team at Glasgow and Edinburgh, the men's team, get a lot of the headlines, as a governing body, we're really focused on making sure every element of our sport restarts in the most effective way. So it's been really pleasing to get the plans approved and progress for the women's team to get back together. So, big year ahead.
It's why professional sport is a public health intervention. So I care about the professional sportsmen and women being good athletes and looking after themselves. But it's much, much more than that. So the public health intervention is your elite sports people encourage, inspire people who are 5'6" to play whatever they can play in their back garden, or 14-year-olds to take it more seriously at school, or folk to go for a run. You underestimate that at your peril, and I don't think rugby does underestimate it. I think your community-based approach, your local clubs, your reach out into schools is really, really important. So women's elite rugby coming back, it's not just about that. It's about the 15-year-old girl in a comprehensive school in Motherwell who sees that and thinks, you know what, I'm going to get a bit fitter. That makes that a public health intervention. It's hugely important sport. And that's why you have advocates in the government to get elite sport back. It's not just because we fancy a game at Murrayfield, an international game. It's a public health intervention for the whole population that is why sport is so important to a culture and a country, particularly in Scotland where sport is so crucial. The only other thing I would say you could maybe tell your players that one of the punishments the football players are getting is they've been sent a 7-minute video of me yelling at them, and they're all and they're all going to have to watch it. So if the rugby players don't behave themselves, that's the punishment, and that's a bad, bad punishment for these guys. So the football players are getting it tonight.
How was your language? Was it clean?
It was very clean, Chris. You could kind of see in my eyes that there were other words. There were other words available, but I decided to try and do it with my head screwed on to try and it's a joke. But actually, what we did was we told them a little bit. We did at the beginning here with when Jamie asked me the first question. We tried to express to them the seriousness of the virus. I think people have forgotten that it kills people. It's not a cold. We're not trying to stop people catching the cold. We live with infectious disease all the time. Every year there's infectious disease and we just carry on. This is different. So if you take risks, people die. So that the captains last night kind of, you saw them sit back in their chair and thought, oh, right, he's not messing around. But, and I'm not doing it to scare them. I'm doing it because it's true.
Yep.
So you need to keep that perspective and then come out safely, which is what we've been talking about.
I think it's a really interesting one, even from a wider society, that things like this, unfortunately, at times are used to remind people how serious it is. Because your point about the amount of lives that have been lost is one that's not going to be missed by anybody. And that we used to talk an awful lot about standards as opposed to rules, and everybody's standards and how they go about their day-to-day business has a massive effect on people's health, on the economy, on the people who aren't necessarily the ones running about on the park, scoring the goals or scoring the tries, but the people that are in behind that making it work. So let's hope, although we never want to have these bad ones, let's hope the last couple high-profile ones have that effect on everybody, and I'm sure that's your hope as well, Jason.
It is my hope, and if there's lessons to be learned, there will be discipline for clubs and discipline for players and all of that. But actually, that's not really what interests me. What interests me most is learning as a nation to help us on that road out of this virus. Because now we are in internationally, we're in a relatively good position, and we put that at risk at our peril. The chief medical officer in England last week was asked about schools opening, and he said that he thinks we've reached the edge of what we can safely open without a vaccine. So if you take that, it means if you're going to move, you've got to do it in a very strict and controlled way, because if you just open everything, the virus is going to come back and our intensive care units are going to fill up. And that's what we've got to try and avoid. So rugby, I think, I'm not just blowing smoke, rugby has been a good example of how you do that, of how you come out. And other sectors have done it. Oil and gas has done it really well. Actually, a lot of hospitality has done it really well as well. The tourism industry, I hear lots of good reports of hotels with one-way systems, with restaurants very distant. So it is possible to do it. But you just need a few rogue traders over on the edge, and you end up with 800 people self-isolating in Aberdeen.
Well, Jason, I know you're the most popular man in Scotland at the moment.
Not with football today.
Not with football players at the moment. But we really appreciate you coming back on the podcast, and Dominic Mackay as well. We appreciate you both coming on to give us that update, and no doubt we'll get you both on soon for a further update. But thank you, gents, and take care.
Fascinating as always, wasn't it, Mossy?
You're always learning something, aren't you? I think the nature of the situation we're in is just ever-changing. Minute by minute, day by day, it's been like that for the last 5-6 months or whatever. So it's such a difficult period for everyone to try and plan, prepare, to live as close to a normal life as possible. But it's good to hear the optimism. It's good to hear from the horse's mouth is, right the level at the moment. Or the infections in Scotland, and you can sense the fact that you are pushing forward and trying to creep forward a little bit to get more, I suppose, normality back. But we're on a fine line. One wrong move, and it's such a fine line. But I think it's good to hear that we're looking forward.
Yeah, that vulnerability. It's human nature to push that to one side and concentrate on what you've got, and then you take something to happen high profile to bring you back to that. And to hear it there from Jason, just the numbers and yeah, how much of a knife edge you're on probably brings it back to the forefront of people's minds, which is massively important as well.
But you can also see that the amount of work and preparation and planning that's going into what would normally be a fairly routine event, like holding a game of rugby, even a club game, a domestic game, a training session
yeah.
for your community-based team. The level of detail that has to go in to make that safe now is far greater than it, I assume, it was before. But it's also far more respected probably than it ever has been before. So it is the people, the volunteers, everybody out there doing their little bit in order to make sure the wheels can keep turning and we can get back to BT Murrayfield and cheering the teams on.
Well, talking about cheering those teams on, I mean, the one thing, all things going well, and central advice allowing, it's an incredible run-in for the next kind of 6 to 8 months as far as rugby's concerned, both from a pro team level and international level for both the men and the women. There's a lot of great games coming.
You could pick up about 25 caps this year, Al.
they'll be after you.
They'll overtake me. It's 4 days they're after. Four days top of the tree, isn't it? But the it's funny because there are a lot of games, but they're going to be intense. You're going to have to prepare properly. I mean, you mentioned the women. Obviously, kind of difficult news this week coming out about Philip Doyle, haven't they? Or unable really to come back. Yeah. See at the rest of his contract, you know, shielding issues around COVID-19. But Brian Eason, who's been involved all the way through, cracking coach, we both know Barney really well, and he was a big part of the Scotland women under Philip Doyle, and they got on great guns. So he'll hopefully continue the good work and add to that with the Scottish women. But there's so many games for them. You know, they've got 3 games of the Six Nations, and then you said World Cup qualifiers, and then another Six Nations, and hopefully a World Cup after that. And there's a 7-week window for the men's national team from October to December. More derbies, you know, over Christmas. It's before the Six Nations again, so it's such a condensed period. There's a Lions goal for a lot of players at the end of that season as well. So it's all going to have to be done off the back of a rather kind of strange period, but hard work and, I suppose, trusting medics, trusting strength and conditioners, trusting each other, and periodising your season so you're not using every ounce of energy every day, and it means you can't fulfil the season.
It has to be a tip of the hat to the rugby operational managers, the medics, as you say, all the work that's going to have to go around in the background. As far as a player's concerned, and we've both been there, that you simplify it down, especially as you get closer to the game. It's about that 80 minutes. Everybody in the background is trying to make it as simple as possible for these players to perform, but there's a huge amount of work going to have to go in to deliver these games. But they are exciting games. They're exciting games if you're a player, and exciting games from a spectator point of view, whether that is at home watching on the telly, or as Dominic alluded to, ideally, hopefully we get small crowds in, but who knows, mm-hmm. We'll have to wait and see what's safe and possible.
But you know what, at the moment, players won't even look at that. They'll be looking at the 22nd, those in Edinburgh and Glasgow, they'll be fighting for a space, they'll be desperate to get up and running. They probably won't even know what happens the next game week. It's all focused on that first game. You just imagine the outburst of energy and aggression and speed and creativity that's been built up. We'll look forward to seeing how it pans out a week on Saturday.
We can dig into it a bit more next week, but I've got to say, Mossy, when Edinburgh, huge amount to play for. Glasgow, less so. There's an outside chance for me. Glasgow just need to make it everything that you tried to make it not, and make it personal, and make it aggressive, and make it nasty. Whereas Edinburgh can do, the approach that you took to it was be professional, just make sure you are focusing on the game, on the 80 minutes itself. But it's going to be a couple of brilliant games.
I'm going to use this quote for the second time after Jason. Keep the heed, Al. Keep the heed. Keep the heed. That's what I'd say.
Oh, well, I'd be telling a boy, Glasgow boys, the opposite.
That's all from us this week on the official Scottish Rugby podcast. Thank you so much for listening. But as always, we will be back next week with more exclusive content around the game in Scotland.